The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Sports Talk 1240 is brought to you by DraftPot.com. DraftPot is changing fantasy sports. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with promo code SportsTalk1240 and receive a 100% deposit bonus up to $1,500. And now, Sports Talk 1240.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through this first hour on the Sunday night, the 11th day of October. Before we turn things over to Raymond Mora for hour number two, our engineer Brian Graves is across the way. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in the great Hall of Fame shortstop, the Wizard of Oz, Ozzie Smith, will join us. In the second half, we'll turn our attention to football and speak to four-time Super Bowl champion with the Pittsburgh Steelers, Rocky Blyer. He'll be with us later on. So sit back, relax, enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on WGBB. We've got some great stuff ahead in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page, cleverly titled Sports Talk 1240. There you can find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, and then you can give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at SportsTalk1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, my first guest played for the San Diego Padres and the St. Louis Cardinals from 78 to 96. He was a 15-time All-Star and won the National League Gold Glove at shortstop for 13 consecutive seasons. He was a World Series champ in 1982 and, of course, elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York in 2002. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight the Wizard, Ozzie Smith. Ozzie, good evening.
Hey, Bill, how you doing?
Great. It's great to have you with us, Ozzie.
Thanks for having me.
Don't know if you remember me. I'm the guy from Play Ball with the bad back.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Okay. Now, right off the bat, Ozzie, I got to put you on the spot as one of the greatest shortstops ever to play the game. What did you think of Chase Utley's supposed slide into Ruben Tejada of the Mets last night at Dodger Stadium in the NLDS?
Well, Bill, you know, there's a lot that's been said about this here, and, you know, I think that it's a bad situation any way you look at it because you hate to see guys get hurt that way. I think one of the biggest mistakes that Tejada made was turning his back.
Okay.
Anytime you turn your back, you put yourself in jeopardy of getting injured. I think that in that situation, you got to take inventory of what's happening. If your second baseman has to range far left or right, you got to know that you just got to get an out. Don't try and do anything more than get an out in that situation. And I think that turning his back just really exposed him to. Now, Utley's job is to break it up and not break anyone's leg, but to break the double play up. So you got to figure the guy's going to be coming in hard. In that situation, I think it's just experience at knowing that in this situation, as far as the second baseman had to go to get that ball, that the best that we're going to do here is get an out.
Mm-hmm.
And he exposed himself to injury by turning his back to the runner coming down.
Good point, Ozzie, yeah. People, unfortunately, around here aren't looking at it like that. And Monday night there'll be a big showdown at Citi Field. Who do you like in the series?
Well, at this point, you know, it's anybody's ball game. It's the guys that go out there and pitch and catch and throw and hit and do it more consistently than the other team. You know, it generally boils down to being able to make a play when a play needs to be made or making a pitch when a pitch has to be made. And that's postseason baseball, man. And you play hard all year to get yourself in this situation, and you hope that when the situation does arise that you're able to rise to that occasion and do something good because a lot of careers are made in postseason.
Exactly. Now, your Cards are involved in a nice contest with the Cubs. Who do you like see coming out of that series on top, Ozzie?
Well, of course, you know, I'm pulling for the Cardinals.
Sure.
But the Cubs have certainly proven that they are very worthy of being in postseason. You know, they've got their ace going tomorrow, and it's going to be a tough hill to climb for the Cardinals. You know, They've got to find a way to win one ball game there in Chicago and come back here on Thursday. But, you know, it's right before you. You have your destiny in your own hands. You know, you just got to go out and you got to play the way that you've played to this point, and hopefully that's enough to get you to the next round.
Exactly. It's going to be a great series either way. We're speaking to Ozzie Smith tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, your famous backflip. Some of the kids wanted me to ask you about the backflips, Ozzie, as they did in Cooperstown. That's a huge deal, is the backflips. Now, from what I read when I was doing my homework, they started at a local lumber yard for you.
Yes, it did. I live across the street from a wood factory, so I used to go over and tumble in the sawdust. And on Thursdays, we were allowed to go to a family fun center where they had trampolines in ground. And we'd tumble from one trampoline over the concrete to another. It's kids. We had to be more creative with the games that we played when we were young. And that was one of them. It was a dare. You know, I dare you. I don't think you can flip from this trampoline to that trampoline. So became pretty efficient at it. And, you know, it's just one of those things I've always been able to do. And then in spring training in 1978 as a rookie, we had to run 2 miles after practice. And I wasn't particularly fond on running long, especially long distances. So I was near the back of the pack. So the old guys gave me a hard time about being the young guy and being at the back of the pack. So to show them I wasn't tired, I did a round-off backflip, and they, like a lot of fans, went crazy over it, and especially one of my teammates, Gene Tennis, had girls that were into gymnastics, and he wanted me to do that for his girls at some point in time during the season, which I wasn't able to do. So Fan Appreciation Day, which was the last day of the season, they coerced me into doing it, going out to my position, and people liked it so much they asked me to do it opening day the following year, and
the rest is history.
That's how I got my trademark.
Outstanding. So good old Gino Tanacci was involved in that. Yeah. Okay. Now, you credit former Padres skipper Alvin Darke, who's a great baseball man. Every player that's associated with Alvin that I have on the show, Ozzie, always gives raves to Alvin Darke. You credit him with giving you the confidence to play every day.
Yes, he gave me my opportunity. You know, at the time that the in 1977, you know, I got a chance to go to Instructional League, and from Instructional League, I was told that I had an invite to big league camp, and at the time they had Billy Allman was their number one pick, you know, so I figured that it would be a few years before I would get the opportunity to even make it to the big leagues. But Alvin saw something in me, and invited me to big league camp in 1978. And, of course, as baseball goes, Alvin was fired in spring training. And I can remember the day that he called me in and said, hey, this is baseball and this happens. He said, and when I sat down, he said, all you have to do, continue to pick the baseball up and get it across the diamond, son, because I've seen a lot of them. He said, you're going to be a great one.
Nice coming from Alvin Darke. Now,
yes, indeed.
You had a deteriorating relationship with the Padres, Ozzie, with the front office, contract problems. Your agent seemed like a very illustrious fellow, though. he told him you were taking a year off to ride in the Tour de France. Is that true?
Yeah, at the time, I didn't even know what the hell the Tour de France was. But anyway, it created a real firestorm and stuff, and I was offered a gardener's job by the ownership of the Padres, Mrs. Kroc, and
that was quite insulting.
Yeah, it was very insulting.
Yeah,
but, you know, it's just where we were, you know, at that particular time. So you live with it and you move on.
Right.
I certainly moved on, and the opportunity for me certainly came, and I got a World Series ring. I don't think she ever got one, so it worked out.
No, all she got was an assistant gardener out of the deal. Now, you went to St. Louis in a multiplayer deal. The principals, of course, were you and Gary Templeton. He was having his own hard time in St. Louis. How did you feel about leaving San Diego?
Well, I mean, here again, when you get traded for what is probably one of the finest players to ever most talented players to ever wear a pair of spikes, you know, because he was a true 5-tool player and probably one of the best players that I've still seen as a shortstop to this point. There's always pressure because, you know, I didn't want to put any added pressure on myself by coming over here and trying to be something that I was not. So getting here, you know, of course, you always hear, too, that when you move from grass to AstroTurf, you won't be able to get to as many balls and all of that stuff. And I didn't allow myself to get caught up in that. And I found out that when I got here, I was able to cover more ground because I could play deeper.
Exactly. So I just
did what Alvin told me to do. Just track the ball, get it, pick it up, and throw it across the diamond. And that's what I did. And 1978 was one of those 1982 was one of those magical years for me when I came over here with the Cardinals and, you know, given the opportunity. I had to learn the art of hitting at the big league level, which Whitey Herzog gave me, and learn to keep the ball out of the air and utilize my speed a little bit more and have a better understanding of what it was I was trying to do as a hitter. And it all worked out for me in 1982.
You had a little wager going with Whitey, too, didn't you,
I did.
Ozzie?
It was over by midway of the season because for every ground ball that I hit, he gave me $1, and for every fly ball, I gave him $1. Well, it's amazing how quickly you learn how to keep the ball out of the air when a little money's involved.
Yeah, not too bad, yeah. Well, in 82, you also went to the series against Milwaukee, as we said. What do you remember most about that World Series, Ozzie?
Well, you know, here again, I remember the first game. The first game, you know, our first game in being a part of a World Series is always very, very special, and it stands out. Now, ours wasn't beautiful, wasn't pretty, because I think Milwaukee beat us 11-0 that night, and I can remember riding home with Willie McGee, who was living with me at the time, and saying that, you know, we need to take that scouting report that we have and tear it up and throw it away and just play baseball the way that we know how to play. And I think that coming back to the ball club, coming back to the ballpark the next day, we did. We said, hey, you know, we're going to throw that scouting report out, and we're just going to go out and play the way that we're capable of playing. And, you know, it wasn't easy because we were playing a team that was called Harvey's Wallbangers, and they had more home runs than anybody in baseball, and it was tough. So our pitchers had their work cut out for them in keeping us close, which they did a super job at keeping us close and giving us a chance. And we could catch and throw the baseball. We just concentrated on the things that we were capable of doing, and we did them and did them very well.
You sure did. Now, in 1985, the Cards win 101 games. Ozzie hits .276 with 31 stolen bases. Certainly the hitting's coming around, and we have the famous home run. It was all set the stage for the folks. Game 5, okay. NLCS against the Dodgers, tied 2-2 in the bottom of the ninth. Fellow Hall of Famer Tommy Lasorda brings in Tom Niedenfuhr, his closer, to try to lock things down. You come to the plate. Now, you haven't hit a home run in 3,009 Major League plate appearances from the left side, Ozzie.
Right.
Go ahead and tell us what happens.
And I certainly was not trying to hit a home run in that situation. You know, one of the things that was very frustrating for me was that as a hitter, anytime I hit a fly ball, I hear people say he's trying to hit a home run. I was just trying to learn to hit the ball hard. And in 1985, things all came together for me. As you mentioned, I started working with a guy by the name of Mackie Shillstone, who took Michael Spinks from a light heavy to a heavyweight.
Mm-hmm.
He currently works with Serena Williams. He's worked with Will Clark. He's worked with Riddick Bowe. I mean, Mackie is one of these gurus that that knows his craft, knows his business, and he helped me with nutrition and weightlifting, not to hit the ball out of the ballpark, but just to get a little bit stronger so I could back the defense up a little bit. And I'd learn how to pull the ball, and you know, all of those things incorporated allowed me in 1985 to have the type of year, one of my best offensive years. And in that situation with Niedenfuhr, they've always pounded me in, and I'd learned to turn on the ball. So their pattern had not changed, and there were a couple pitches just before the home run that I fouled straight back that I felt that if he got it out over the plate a little bit, I could, you know, get the good part of the bat on, and which I did. He supplied the power. I supplied the technique, and history was made, but I certainly was not in that instance trying to hit the ball out of the ballpark.
That was, folks, the late, great Jack Buck's famous call, go crazy, folks, go crazy, and in Busch Stadium. And that was voted by the fans as one of the greatest moments in Busch Stadium history, if not the, I believe, Ozzie.
Yeah, it was a magical moment. You know, we happen to be in a business, Bill, that it's in the memory-making business. And we create memories that last a lifetime. And what greater honor or blessing than to have the ability to be able to be on a stage where you can create memories for people that last a lifetime. And certainly for me, that was a crowning moment, and it was magical because, you know, we had to win three games at home to give ourselves a chance to go back out to Los Angeles. And that probably more than anything is really what was really important. It gave us a chance. And, of course, Jack Clark finished him off at Chavez Ravine there in Dodger Stadium.
He did. Now, in 87, Ozzie, you moved up to number two in the lineup. You hit 303. Now, 75 RBIs, 104 runs scored. You win the Silver Slugger Award at shortstop. Now, you go from Gold Glove to winning the Silver Slugger as well. What do you attribute that rise in the batting average and all of a sudden the offensive potency?
Well, it's really the opportunity and then the hard work. I mean, I tell kids today that, you know, you only get out of something what you put in it, Bill. If you don't put anything in, you shouldn't expect anything in return. And for me, it was just about putting the work in. There was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that went into, you know, making myself a much better offensive player. And coming into baseball, I didn't want to be a one-dimensional player. I wanted to be as well-rounded as I could possibly be, and I really think that that's the goal of every player that comes in, to be as well-rounded as you can be, and it was no different for me. So I worked extremely hard at making sure that I became a better offensive player and was not a detriment to my team.
And that you weren't, that's for certain, Ozzie. You beat the Giants in the NLCS that year, but you lost to the Twins in the series. You finished second in the MVP vote to the Hawk, fellow Hall of Famer Andre Dawson. That may have been because you and Jack split the first-place vote. Do you think that's so, Ozzie?
Yeah, it probably had a lot to do with it. And, you know, you look for, you know, certainly going into that season, you hate to lose a player like Jack Clark, and he certainly was a big piece of the machine for us. And when he went down, you know, so did a big part of the offense that we had. And we came up short, and we just couldn't get around that. Terry Pendleton also was a big part of that in 1987. And losing those two guys, I think, really took a lot from our offense, as did losing Vince Coleman in 1985.
Vince Coleman, exactly. We're speaking to Ozzie Smith tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, Ozzie, exactly what changed when Gussie Bush passed away? The mantle passed from from Whitey to Joe Torre. Tell us about some of the changes that happened within the organization and with that Cardinal ball club.
Well, I think that once Mr. Bush passed, I don't think that there was as much interest in the baseball operation as for Anheuser-Busch. Baseball was everything to Mr. Bush, and I don't think that anybody dared touch it because it was his beloved team and stuff. But once he passed away, you know, the interest in it, I think that salaries were rising, and from a corporate standpoint, they weren't interested in you know, making paying players more than they paid their executives. So, once that changed, you know, you didn't go out and you didn't spend for the free agents. And so it made for a very tough road for us.
Yeah, it did. Now, you also run into Tony La Russa, whom you didn't get along with.
Well, it wasn't that I didn't get along. I mean, I don't still to this day don't understand what that was all about because I certainly didn't feel that I was any detriment to this team. You know, even at my age, there was something that I could bring to this team. But, you know, he never gave us an opportunity. And, you know, that's one of the most unfortunate things that happened in my career and stuff. When I look back on it, you know, that was a little disappointing. But, you know, things happen.
It's a shame. It really is. And you were treated well by the Cardinals, though. You retired. You had your uniform number retired by the Cardinals. Now, that's a great honor. That's, in the National League, the equivalent of being retired by the Yankees, only the Cardinals don't retire numbers at the drop of a hat like our friends across town do. But that had to be a great honor for you.
Oh, yeah, anytime. You know, here again, I think as a player, you never start out saying to yourself that, you know, one day I'm going to have my number retired and I'm going to make the Hall of Fame. I think the goal, the real goal is Joe Carter's dream of 1993.
Yeah.
Being able to stand at the plate in the bottom of the ninth and get the big hit that wins it for your team. He did it with a home run and stuff to win the World Series. And everything beyond that is becomes just icing on the cake. You know, you want to be that player that when people come to the ballpark, they say, you know what, that guy was worth the price of admission. And I, you know, I just work hard at trying to be the best that I could be every day, and making the Hall of Fame and stuff became a byproduct of that. And it's the message that I give the kids today. You know, be the best that you can be in whatever it is you choose to do, because that was the message that was preached to me all the time, and I live by that creed.
Definitely, and education obviously means a lot to you, to Ozzie. You come back and you do the play ball for Ozzie Smith at the Hall of Fame every year. Talk about your role a little bit with the Hall of Fame.
Well, I'm in. When I got to the Hall of Fame, I got inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2002. They made me their first educational ambassador. Now, what I always had a program that was called Turn 2, where I was raising monies for charities in my local area. Excuse me. And it was a perfect fit for what they were trying to do, because the educational department, you know, it has to have funds to continue to educate, and the Hall of Fame there, you know, the people do a super job of trying to educate while at the same time run a museum. So what I've done is gotten together with a lot of my friends and given people an opportunity to come down on the field and throw the ball around with us, and when, as it says, turn two. And it gives them an opportunity to visit with people that they've admired from a distance for a long period of time. They're heroes. And we try and raise a lot of money. And it gives people the opportunity, I think, to see guys on a totally different level and realize that, you know, they're human beings, too, that enjoy some of the same things that they enjoy in life. And we have fun doing it.
It's certainly obvious that you do, Ozzie. And I tell you, it is an unforgettable experience, having gone through it myself this summer, folks. Unforgettable experience, play ball with Ozzie Smith before Hall of Fame weekend every year. Now, Ozzie, taking a look at your legacy, if someone's in the plaque gallery walking through and they stop and they pause and they look up and they see Osborne Smith, what would you like them to think about after they read your plaque?
Well, you know, here again, it's think of me as a player whom they enjoyed playing, whether they were a Dodger fan or a Met fan or a Houston Astro fan. You know, that's the one great thing about the Hall of Fame. In the Hall of Fame, I think everybody that comes up, that makes that trek there, we go there because of our love for the game of baseball. And there you can put all of your problems and all of your anguish or all your madness at another team, or another player, because you love the game. And so it's a great place for baseball people to meet. I've been going back since my induction in 2002, and hopefully, and God willing, I'll be able to do it for many years to come.
I hope you will, too, Ozzie. And I tell you, next year I'm going to be able to bend down and pick that ball up.
Okay, Bill. I know you will. I know you'll work hard at it.
Well, Ozzie, I tell you, it's been an honor and a pleasure having you with us tonight, talking about your great career in the Hall of Fame and the St. Louis Cardinals. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday evening to be with us.
All right, Bill. Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
And we'll see you in Cooperstown next summer.
Okay. Thanks, Bill.
Take care. Ozzie Smith, bye-bye. Ladies and gentlemen. Right now, folks, I'd like to give a little glance at food in the ballpark, because we went to Citi Field about a week ago before the season ended. In fact, it was the last game of the year. And the tickets we had are $145 seats, of course, given to us by somebody, because I can't afford to do that. You know that. And the tickets included food. It was in the Hyundai Club right behind home plate. And all game long, all you can do is you can go back and just keep filling up your plate. There's an endless buffet. There's pasta primavera. There's chicken. There's beef. There's salad, a salad bar. There's pretzels, the big pretzels you can put mustard on. There's a hot dog wagon where you can have bacon ensconced hot dogs. It's a Bacchanalian feast for the baseball fan. Just keep going back for more and more, and it's hilarious watching people do this, watching what they come back with. One lady had a cooler and constantly filling it up with more food. I don't know whether she was feeding a third world nation or what, but that was her mission. And when the food's complete and the game's moving on towards its latter stages, they wheel out an ice cream cart with ice cream, chip witches, and all kinds of stuff, which just makes you think of how far ballpark fare has come. I mean, there's an article in Memories and Dreams magazine from the Hall of Fame about Boog Powell's barbecue that they have in Baltimore. There's the Dodger dog. There's the Fenway Frank. There's Greg Luzinski in Philadelphia. The Bulls barbecue in Philadelphia. Manny Sanguian down in Pittsburgh, the former Pirate catcher, has his barbecue stand. PNC Park in Pittsburgh is where that's located. There's Cuban sandwiches at Luis Tion. Our guest a few weeks ago has the El Tiante Grill on Yawkey Way in Boston. There's really no end to the fare at the ballpark these days, and it's just tremendous to be able to watch people go to the ball game, and it's like a shopping mall with a baseball game in the middle of it, with people just going there to eat, really, and the baseball game is kind of secondary. And how we doing, Brian? We're ready to go? Okay. Well, it was great talking to Ozzie. Up next, we'll talk to former Pittsburgh Steelers Super Bowl champion Rocky Blyer on Sports Talk 1240. So stay with us, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Be sure and visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Hey, fantasy sports fans. DraftPot has an exclusive offer for Sports Talk 1240 listeners. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit up to $1,500. That's right. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit up to $1,500. What are you waiting for? Do it now.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your GustBuster today.
Whether you're a couple enjoying a romantic meal for two, a family wanting to dine in a relaxed and friendly setting, or a larger party wanting to celebrate a special occasion, Miller Place Pastoria always combines a warm welcome with the finest contemporary Italian cuisine and wines, also serving up Long Island's favorite pizza. We're located right on Route 25A in Miller Place. Come visit us today and check us out online at mppastoria.com.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you tonight. I hope you had a great weekend. Great weather here on Long Island. So much happening. The MLB playoffs, pro and college football, and now the NHL is back. So sports abound. I hope you're enjoying Sports Talk 1240 tonight, most importantly. My next guest was a member of the Pittsburgh Steelers in 1968 and then from 71 to 80. He's a four-time Super Bowl champion as well as a Purple Heart and Bronze Star hero from the Vietnam War. It's my pleasure to welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Mr. Rocky Blyer. Rocky, good evening.
Hey, Bill. How are you doing this evening?
It's great to have you with us, Rocky.
Hey, thank you. Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Well, Rocky, let's start off in college. You graduated from the great University of Notre Dame in 1968 with a degree in business management. You remember their 96 national championship team, captain of the 67 squad. Tell us a little bit what it was like in those days playing at Notre Dame Stadium with 60,000 people and playing for the great Ara Parseghian.
You know, I think what one of the things that people have to understand is that Ara came in my freshman year, so I was very fortunate to be part of his first recruited class. But no one really knew what to expect, you know, from Ara. He came from Northwestern, you know, had a winning record there. And so then he takes over the program at Notre Dame. That first year in 1964, my freshman year, and just to let people understand is that freshmen weren't allowed to play, on the varsity at that time. So, you know, we practice against the varsity, but all of a sudden, Ara goes, 9-1 and turns a program around that, for the last 12 years or the decade before was not a heralded program as it came out of from Leahy's period of time. Mm-hmm. And so Notre Dame had been in a funk, and all of a sudden Ara comes out on the scene. There's some rule changes. He has a plethora of talent, and he turns it around, and they go 9-1. All of a sudden brings Notre Dame back to the forefront. So, and he brings a... You know, and at least from my point of view, I mean, what he brings is maybe the expectation that you had of what a head coach should be like. He was very organized. He was intense. He was very knowledgeable about every position, and how to play that position. So, when you asked him a question, there would be an answer. He wouldn't fluff you off. He knew, you know, what needed to be done and how to manage and the expectations of what he wanted from you. And thus you lived up to it. Mm-hmm. So that's what he brought, which was new, I think, to a lot of people. And then all of a sudden, you know, in 72 and then, I mean, 72 in 60, in 65 and then 66, you know, he brings this team together that goes undefeated, and we end up playing the Michigan State in 1966 for the heralded national championship. What people have to understand is that there was no playoff games.
Right.
Well, there was no playoff games. It was the first time in years that the two number one ranked teams in the polls got a chance to finally play at the end of the season against one another for that definitive national champion. Now we understand who's going to be national champion. And
right.
The game ended in a tie.
That was the famous game of the century, the 10-10 tie versus Michigan State.
There was no playoffs. I mean,
right.
There was no overtime. There was, you know, there was no sudden death. It was just the game, and it ended in a tie. Fortunately, I think for us, it was the end of Michigan State's. That was their last game. We had one more game in which we went out and played Southern Cal on national television and beat them 51-0.
Right.
On national television. And then the next day, they voted, and we were the number one ranked team that season. So we were very proud, even though we had a tie, to be able to, you know, wear that mantle.
But certainly,
That's what Era brought, and he got the most out of his talent, and people respected him for who he was, his leadership, and he had a great staff. And I think that all successful organizations, ultimately, and if you look at teams, have great assistant coaches, because that's who you relate to. Your running back coach, your line coach, your linebacker coach, your defensive back coach, and that head coach sets the tone. So
exactly.
it was a great run. It was and I think every one of us who played for Era were very fortunate that we had him as our college coach.
Indeed. Now you were drafted in '68, Rocky, after your rookie season with Pittsburgh, and you you volunteered for duty in Vietnam. You were shipped out in May of '69. Set the stage for us, if you will, for the life-altering ambush that you experienced in Vietnam.
Well, so at that time, as for those of us who lived through it, and maybe, some of your listening audience, it was a draft, and we don't have a draft today.
Exactly, right.
And it was before the lottery system, and so everybody had to register, and you became eligible for the draft, and it was kind of a random choice. And I was playing for the Steelers, and ultimately I kind of fell through the cracks, whatever the reason, and I got drafted. And so I went to the service and ended up in Vietnam. And that experience that had taken place when I was wounded was that our sister company had been hit out in the field about 2 days previously, and we were helicoptered out to the field to get them out of their hot spots. So our platoon and our company went out, and eventually we pulled front and rear security, got them out of that hot spot late at night. In the meantime, we ran into an ambush. And we were carrying some of our soldiers who were killed, and we had to leave them to get ourselves out of there. Mm-hmm. We are now 2 days later, we are coming back to retrieve those bodies that we left behind. Then, and that was the action in which I got hit. We ran into what we called unavoidable ambush. We ran into some North Vietnamese regulars, and we were on an open race paddy, the open fire, and so we were kind of sitting ducks, and we got into a firefight. That's when I got hit the first time in that rice paddy. Then later on the same day, I got hit with a grenade that blew up to my right foot, knee, and thigh until another platoon fought its way down finally and got us out of there. And maybe 6 hours later, we got to a security area. Helicopters came in and air vac'd us out of that situation.
Unbelievable.
But the prognosis was primarily from my wounds later on, as I went through Da Nang and Tokyo, and then came back to the States, where I spent 9 months in a hospital and went through three operations. The prognosis was that I would never be able to play again.
That's what they that's what they told you in Tokyo. Yeah, that you wouldn't be able to play. But you received a nice note from Art Rooney.
As it would be, yes. So unbeknownst to me, I get a postcard in the mail as I'm in Tokyo, and it basically said, "Rock, team's not doing well. We need you, Art Rooney." Two sentences that changes my life, because all of a sudden it was like, whether they needed me, I knew that they didn't need me, but it was somebody that took the time and effort to respond and reach out and give words of comfort, at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So being the family that they are and they continue to be, they gave me the opportunity when I got out of the service to be able to come back and try to make the team. And I limped through that first year when I came back, and it took its toll. And they were kind enough, and they put me on injured reserve at that time. And so they kind of bought me a year, and I have to tell you that in all honesty. And and I had another operation. And so I came back, and I hung around that year and went to the meetings and so on. And the following year, I came back, and I made the developmental squad, the taxi squad at that time. Right. Really what they did was buy me 2 years to get bigger, stronger, to heal, and then give me an opportunity to see what I could do, and that was 1972. And so I make the team in 72, primarily playing special teams, and we have a young rookie by the name of Franco Harris. Nobody knew who he was until a fateful day. And he was had a tremendous rookie year. Franco did, but probably more were best known for the deflected pass in the Oakland game, and the first time in 40 years that the Steelers had gotten to the playoffs. And you know, as the immaculate reception that got us into the championship game, in which we lost to Miami to their perfect season that year. But it put us on a map and kind of gave us a sense of belief that maybe we got something here that we can develop over the years.
Now, you worked real hard, Rocky, to get yourself back. We're speaking of Rocky Blyer tonight. And what I read is that you worked real hard so you didn't have to ask yourself, what if someday?
Well, you know, I think that we go through life with, you know, like, well, what if I did this? Or what if I did this? I guess I did forget. And I should say this. And I grew up in Appleton, Wisconsin, and I grew up in a bar. And growing up in a bar, you meet a lot of people. And throughout life, you meet a lot of would'ves and could'ves and should'ves, as we continue to do in our life. Mm-hmm. You know, I could have played, I should have played, I would have played, but, or reasons why. And there's all, and I come to understand that there's reasons why maybe sometimes it doesn't happen, but at least, you know, I don't want to be that person, or look at myself and say, well, you know, you didn't do enough, you didn't run enough, you didn't go to the gym, you didn't work out, you know, so if I went through that process myself, you know, is that at least I could look back and say, well, you know, I did everything I possibly could. You know, that decision was out of my hands for whatever reason, but not because I didn't try or I didn't have an effort. And, you know, and I think that a lot of people have that attitude, and they just don't get to tell that story. But, you know, yeah, so that was important to me, so that later on, as we're sitting here talking to you, I get, I could have, but I would have, and I wish I would have.
Right.
You know, I would have done this.
Exactly. Okay. Now, in addition to being a great lead blocker, Rocky, you also were a terrific rushing weapon in your own right, along with the Hall of Famer Franco Harris, effective at both blocking and rushing. In 76, folks, Franco and Rocky rushed for over 1,000 yards. They were the second NFL team to accomplish the feat after the Dolphins, I believe, in 72, did it with Mercury Morris and Larry Zonka.
Correct. And so, in 1970, and so, you know, I always tell people this, is that, you know, it's a wonderful statistic to be able to have. But for me to be able to do that, or Franco and I to be able to do that, not Franco. Franco, you know, was a perennial 1,000-yard rusher.
Uh-huh.
But for me to be able to gain 1,000 yards, something was going to have to happen, you know, to be able to get that accomplished. And the thing that had would happen was that early part of the season, and maybe fourth, fifth game, I can't remember right at this time, we're playing the Cleveland Browns. But there was a defensive end by the name of Joe Turkey Jones, who got a hold of Bradshaw on the backfield and for a sack, and because Bradshaw was a runner, you know, a gritty kind of guy, he didn't go down easy. So Joe Turkey Jones, you know, pile drives him into the turf to make sure he'd go down, and in so doing, you know, left him like knocked out on
yeah.
the field. Well, all of a sudden, he is out for an indefinite period of time. Our backup quarterback is a rookie by the name of Mike Krushek.
Krushek,
so all of a sudden,
right.
Now we got to pare down the offense, you know, and simplify it. And the best way of being able to do that is to control the ball and run the ball. And as a rookie quarterback, you can hand the ball off. Now, what makes that most important is our defense. in those remaining nine games, you have to understand, we lost four out of our first five games. And at the time, we only played 14 games. So you can find yourself behind the eight ball very quickly.
Uh-huh.
So in those remaining nine games, that defense shut out five of those opponents. They only allowed 23 points scored in those nine games, minus yards rushing, and I think an average of 123 total yards per game, which was almost like three and out, which, if you think about it, allowed the offense to be on the field that much more. And so if we ran the ball, controlled the ball, and I get my share of carries, all of a sudden I'm close to getting to 1,000.
Exactly, yeah.
So I every day, every time I get a chance, and if I'm in Cleveland or at some function and I see Joe Turkey Jones, I thank him profusely for that sack that he made because it allowed me to get 1,000 yards rushing.
That's a great story, Rocky. We're speaking of Rocky Blyer tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, you played with so many illustrious characters on those Steeler ball clubs. We spoke about Franco Harris. Talk a little bit about Bradshaw, a little bit more about Terry.
You know, I think it's an interesting, when Terry came in, Terry's 22 years old, so he's from Louisiana Tech, and
right.
He grew up, on a farm, beloved by his mom and dad, and so all of a sudden, boom, he's in Pittsburgh. He's the number one pick, and there's this huge expectation because of his athleticism, to be able to be the savior of the Steelers. And you're 22 years old, and it becomes a difficult transition. And like anybody else, he's more in a fishbowl. And so every mistake he makes, every wrong choice, whatever it might be, is just magnified that much greater. And so in the beginning of his career, all of a sudden, he's on top of the world, but he's not on top of the world. And he's got Terry Hanratty, so then
right.
It's kind of a duel between the quarterbacks. And then Joe Gillum comes in like 72 or 71, 72. And you have to understand that. So it goes back and forth. And Bradshaw's got all the physical ability, but he is not Chuck Knoll's kind of guy, whatever Chuck Knoll's kind of guy would have been. I can only imagine. I think it would be like Roger Staubach.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. Right. There's a little bit of difference there between those
right.
two. Yeah.
So if you, to your listening audience, if I should say Roger Staubach and Terry Bradshaw, I know immediately there are two different images that just popped into your mind of those kind of guys.
Exactly.
Okay. And so by 1974, Bradshaw's on the bench. Bill Dillon is the starting quarterback, and that's the year we go to our first Super Bowl. But I tell you this, is that we would not have gone to that Super Bowl if it wasn't for Bradshaw. We would not have won those four Super Bowls if it wasn't for Bradshaw. As much talent as we had offensively, as we need to know, people need to know, is that you need to score. You need to have a leader. You need to make big plays. Defense can do a wonderful job. All they can do is shut out the opponent unless they, score themselves. But it's an offense that needs to do it. So Bradshaw was that kind of a leader, and then ultimately, he made the things happen. As I tell people, I said I do not think that we would ever won those four Super Bowls if we did not have him as our quarterback.
Okay, now how about Chuck Knoll himself, the great head coach?
Well, much like I was talking about Era Parsegian, Chuck Knoll was kind of out of that same mold. His nickname, not by us, but prior to coming to Pittsburgh in college when he played for the Cleveland Browns, was the Pope.
Okay.
Okay, why? Because he was never wrong. And the reason he was never wrong is because he was a student of the game. He always had an answer. He always had the answer. He was one of those guys that you wanted to be with as a student. You wanted him to be, you know, in a classroom, he went right next to you, you know, because he was the he's the one that knew all the answers. But that transferred over into his ability to be able to coach, and he became, you know, that coach of he knew the positions, he knew how to coach, he knew what needed to, how to play linebackers and or offensive line and what they were trying to, and it was his offense. And his defense that actually was developed, you know, through his assistants. But, you know, Chuck had a big impact. You as a player respected Chuck. You weren't his friend. He didn't want to be your friend, you know, because he was the head coach. Ultimately, he had to make those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But in that position, you respected him because of his knowledge. Because he was the head coach, because you knew that he had the answer to the question before you even thought of what the question might be. And so that is kind of an awesome person to be able to play underneath and to develop a team.
It certainly is. That's some description that you gave of Chuck Knoll, Rocky, I'll tell you. Now, obviously you have a lot of respect for the Rooney family. Art Rooney, one of the great names in NFL history. Talk a little bit more about Art and his role with the Steelers and with your career.
Well, you know, I mean, the chief, as he's as he was known by many people, Mr. Rooney, who started the team in 1933. You know, so he was kind of, you know, you had to understand, he was a Pittsburgh guy, grew up on the north side. He, you know, was a great athlete himself and a better boxer than most people would ever maybe thought that he was. But he played baseball. He played and came up in a time when, you know, Sandlot teams were kind of big, you know, especially in no matter where you talk about Long Island, or you talk about the, you know, you talk about Brooklyn or Staten Island or mm-hmm. or the islands of New York. Everybody had their own little baseball team. You know, there was this team and that team, and so the chief, Mr. Rooney, played for all these teams under assumed names at times. You know, at one time he was offered. He was offered a major league contract. He turned it down because he was making more playing Sandlot baseball under assumed names than he would have if he had signed a major league baseball contract. He's known as a gambler, but he's not he wasn't a gambler. I mean, gambling was a part of his life. And the racetrack was a part of his life because that's who he was. And so, you know, he would bet the races. And so part of his success came from the winnings of what he did and helped support the team throughout those early years. He was a great owner, and those who knew him and those who got a chance to play for him really and truly loved him because he cared about his people. He cared about his players, and he would take care of them. He was a Northside guy in Pittsburgh. He would take care of those people, the guys on the mm-hmm. corner, the guys in the union halls, the guys who were out of work, whatever needed to be done. You know, he'd always give them a 10 spot or whatever it might be. He was that kind of, you know, a guy. Good businessman. I mean, it wasn't a Trump in any means. No one would ever take advantage of him. But there was a concern and a kindness of humanity, and that spread throughout the throughout the team. He was very proud of his organization. He was very proud of Three River Stadium when it was built back in the 70s. As he would have been proud of, you know, of Heinz Field now and the development of the team and where it is, you know, at this point. So he was a great ambassador for the game and his players, and his players really, really respected him. And, you know, and just to be able to have a, you know, he would, he'd be walking by his office, I can remember, through, and he'd ask you to come in, you know, just, hey, come on in. And he'd sit there, and he'd give you a cigar, and then he'd tell you stories. Then he'd tell you stories about growing up on the north side, or tell you stories about racetracks, or tell you stories about characters that he had met, or, and just like you were, you know, a guy next door. And so everybody really appreciated, you know, that. And, you know, he was the kind of guy, and I don't mean to ramble, but he was also the kind of guy that knew something about everybody. I mean, maybe that was one of the keys. He knew something about everybody that he came into contact with. He had an association, whether it be an illness, a sickness, a relative, a place, you know, a restaurant, whatever it might be. So that every time he saw you, he would remind you of that story or of that relative and or that place and or that, you know, or that sickness or restaurant.
Yeah.
And so you had this bond with him. That was unlike anything else. And it was, you know, and he was the owner. And so, you know, it was always nice to be recognized by the owner or to be able to, you know, sit down and have a cigar with him and talk like you were anybody else.
Outstanding. Art Rooney from Rocky Blyer. Rocky retired after the 80 season. He had 3,865 rushing yards, 136 receptions for 1,294 yards, 25 touchdowns. At the time of his retirement, Rocky was the fourth all-time leading rusher in Steelers history. In a few minutes, Rocky, what are you doing these days?
I have a construction company here in Pittsburgh. I spend a lot of time on the road doing speeches. A lot of players do that, but I've had over the last 40 years, do corporate gigs. And so that takes a lot. So between those two and so on, I just did a one man show here in Pittsburgh that was a success. Thank God. Maybe because of the low expectation by the fans, they all thought it was wonderful. But there was a year out of my life to be able to pull that and put that together. And so that was truly an experience to be able to do. Basically that's what keeps me busy here.
Outstanding. Well, I'll tell you, Rocky, it's been an honor and a pleasure having you with us tonight. I thank you for taking the time out to be with us on this Sunday night.
Thank you. It was my pleasure anytime. Just give a call. I'm always available.
Will do, Rocky. You take care.
So. All right.
Rocky Blyer, folks. Well, that'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Ozzie Smith and Rocky Blyer, and, of course, you for taking the time to join us tonight. Stay tuned for hour number two up next with Raymond Mora on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you Sunday night, October 25th, with the great guitar player from the Grateful Dead, the Allman Brothers Band, Warren Haynes. Till then, Bill Donahue wishing you good evening, folks.
Views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.